because there's nothing that is, will require a vote now. So we decided to come and begin to start our meeting. So we apologize to everybody for the inconvenience. Otherwise, today we are having one item on our agenda. We are going to continue with the consideration of the Community Ombuds Service Bill. And our aim was to complete this process today, but unfortunately we don't know. We'll go as far as, in fact, I'm just proposing that if we can go as 7:30, because the last bus leaves at 8 o'clock for the members. So if we can go as far as 7:30, if we have not completed. But if we have completed, we'll leave earlier than that. So that tomorrow is the last day for the committee. We deal with our in-house issues. We've got a lot of reports and minutes that we have to deal with them, so that the issues that we have not finalized tomorrow, we can plan that we come next week before the 25th, because I think after the 25th, no one is going to be around, but committees can continue working up to the 25th. The outstanding issues, they can be finalized by then. So by those few words, I wish to welcome everybody, and I'm going to hand over to Professor. Okay. The whip has got something to say?
No, sure. I think I agree with the timing. Nine, I guess members are much more special. But I wanted just to make a proposal, Chair, just to deal with one issue. I think it would take us 5 minutes even after the presentation on our recommendation, our special recommendation to Parliament on our main report, because it's going to be finalized tomorrow morning. We may not have enough time. It would take us 5 minutes to do that. I guess that we won't really delay all of us at all. It's just as part of your agenda.
No, you are welcome. So we can put it as the second item. Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Whip.
We are on page 9.
Thank you.
Page 9 on the appointment. You're going to commence with the appointment of the Chief Ombuds.
You are correct, Chair. Thank you, Honorable Chair. As we've already indicated, on page 9, clause number 14, dealing with the appointment of Chief Ombuds and Chief Financial Officer.
Sorry, on the huge booklet, it's page 22.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. 14, clause 14.1. The board must, with the approval of the minister, appoint a chief ombud and a chief financial officer to assist the service in meeting its objectives.
The rep from the Parliamentary Legal Unit, when we come across, because now I don't have the copy of Adhikari's comments, but I've got a rough paper. But when we get to the issues, can you just raise your hand so that we will proceed?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Number 14.2, the board must invite applications for the post of the Chief Ombuds and Chief Financial Officer by publishing advertisements in the media. Number 3, the appointment must be made after following a transparent and competitive process. 4, a person appointed as Chief Ombuds or Chief Financial Officer must A, have suitable qualifications and experience relevant to the functions of the service. to 9.
Okay. For men?
Yes, Chairperson. Just in one of the submissions, there was a suggestion that perhaps what we need to be looking at is minimum qualifications rather than suitable qualifications. Now, there might be a reason for the suitable qualifications in the legal job and the sort of using these, but I think we do need to just stop and get an opinion about that.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think the reasons for us not to prescribe, you know, specific qualification is that, you know, we thought, you know, to be prudent, you know, for us, you know, to give an opportunity, you know, to the board, you know, to set out, you know, within its own discretion, to set out the minimum qualification when they advertise, you know, for the post, rather than for us specifically, you know, in terms of legislation to prescribe what, you know, a suitable qualification, you know, should be. Because when they advertise for the particular post, it will of course indicate a minimum qualification and of course, you know, the duties that is expected to be performed, you know, by the chief ombuds and also the chief financial officer. We're thinking that it's a matter that we need to give them that opportunity as a board, to apply their mind with regard to the minimum qualifications.
Why can't we just say suitable qualifications and as per requirement, whether you can put it that way, so that it is clear that we also have an impression that at least somebody is going to take responsibility to advertise and require the minimum standards, I mean, minimum requirements of that. So can you rephrase it? Yes. Okay. I think you're covered.
I think I am covered, but I just want to, is this a normal sort of thing to leave it to boards to come in with visory qualifications? That's a normal standard.
Apologies for coming late. I had to listen to my president speaking, and I don't regret.
No, you are not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Chair. Clause number 15, conditions of appointment of Chief Ombuds and Chief Financial Officer. Clause number 15.1, the appointment of the Chief Ombuds and the Chief Financial Officer is subject to the conclusion of an annual performance contract with the service.
Thank you, Chair. On the last one, we may say that with the services, not with the board.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. You know, that point is noted, to be with the board. Two, the Chief Ombuds and the Chief Financial Officer are appointed for a term of 5 years and may be reappointed for one additional term of 5 years.
Instead of turfing everybody out of the, with a stipulated time, sometimes people can't get rid of people, but...
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Three, the Chief Ombuds hold office on such terms and conditions as the Board may determine in consultation with the Minister of Finance, and the Minister for the Public Service and Administration. Three, the Chief Ombuds holds office on such terms and conditions as the Board may determine in consultation with the Minister of Finance, and the Minister for the Public Service and Administration. Thank you, Chair. B, the Chief Financial Officer hold office on terms and conditions determined by the Chief Ombud within the limits determined by the Board. For the Chief Ombuds and the Chief Financial Officer are executive members of the Board. The Chief Ombud and the Chief Financial Officer are entitled to a remuneration package determined by the Board in consultation with the Minister. Six, the Chief Ombud and the Chief Financial Officer are accountable to the Board. Clause number 16, Honorable Members, is dealing with the removal of the Chief Ombud and the Chief Financial Officer from office. Then clause number 16.1, the Board must, in consultation with the Minister and subject to applicable labour legislation, remove the Chief Ombud and the Chief Financial Officer from office, A, on account of misconduct,
I think those conditions that are set up when we get back to 3B, I think those conditions that are set up by the Board, they shall not be in contravention of the labor relations. I don't know. Or they are whatever, because they are not necessarily the labor relations per se, but I think there are quite a lot of regulations that regulate where all the employees. But I understand that it's the financial officer and ombudsperson person, so it might not be the LRA, but then there might be some regulations on the conditions of employment. So I don't know if it would be make it a point that you refine it. It must be clear, because and the Boards must not do their own thing. And then at the end of the day, because our common court cases are appealed. So it must be captured in this. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Let me repeat number 16. It says the Board must, in consultation with the Minister, subject to applicable labour legislation, remove the Chief Ombuds and the Chief Financial Officer from office. And it says, one, on account of misconduct, B, for failing to perform the duties connected with that office diligently, or C, if the Chief Ombuds or the Chief Financial Officer become subject to any disqualification contemplated in Section 9. Two, the Chief Ombuds and the Chief Financial Officer may resign on written notice of at least 30 days to the Chairperson. The Board may suspend the Chief Ombuds and the Chief Financial Officer during the misconduct proceedings against him or her. Honorable Chair, we have indicated there that subject to the applicable labor legislation.
No,
This suspension must not be forever. I think you are quite right on that one. It must not be. Somebody must not be suspended for specific. We can be specific on that one, because that is a not in contravention of the law. But we want to fast track the disputes. That is the dispute management. That one. So I think we can have something. Honorable Jobe.
I agree with that, Chairperson. Particularly if, for instance, if it is suspension with pay, some people get suspended for years and they are paid for doing nothing. But the point I wanted to refer to was the one you referred to earlier. Do you think, I'm not quite sure what you wanted to be added on that 16.1, Comrade Chairperson, because I was going to ask whether you think it is not sufficient to say the board will remove the chief ombud subject to applicable labor legislation. No. Doesn't that include all the legislation that has got to do
with it? No, that one is fine. It was six. It was on six where it is said the chief ombud and the financial officer are accountable to the board. With the chief ombud and the regulations to be run by the consultation. No, no, this one is fine. This one is fine.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in what I would suggest, Chair, is that maybe under the clause dealing with regulations, if the minister would determine the period of suspension of this particular person, Chair, because, Chair, there may be different circumstances for suspension. There may be, it would depend on the nature of the misconduct, the seriousness also of the misconduct. And then that will determine the period of suspension. It may depend on case by case basis. My fear is that if we prescribe it here, then it may limit the discretion of the board when it is suspending the chief ombud or the chief financial office. I think it will be more, it will be better to have it under the regulations where the minister will determine the period of suspension for the chief ombud or the chief financial office, under clause 29. We may come up with the right wording, Chair, to that effect.
Thank you. No, as much as I agree with you, but there is a minimum period. There is a maximum. Even the constitution, even my organization constitution, it spells clearly Ubuntu must be suspended, and then it disciplinary, you know, even with labor relations, that would be the health. What we are saying here, suspending a person without taking another disciplinary measures, hearing, without setting up a hearing, we village, no, the government. That is why we are saying at least let's try. In fact, I agree with you. We can say as determined in the regulations, because those regulations, even those regulations, so that is called an ad. So I was determined. Because the cartel government, they are going to be suspended. Actually, for 5 years. No, we can't allow that situation. So, now, as we are making the legislation, sine experience. So we are learning from our experiences. and then we review the policies in terms of the experiences. So we have got an experience on this one of suspending people for an indefinite period. So, Prof, and the state law advisor, Nina, I'm proposing that, Nina, what you can do here is determined with regulations. And then we'll work it out with regulations. See you later, Mrs. Zongeji. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The board... I wanted to repeat it here so that it can be clear. The board may suspend the chief ombudsman or the chief financial officer during the misconduct proceeding against him or her, and we have agreed here that it can only, of course, reweight and then has determined the regulations or not for longer than 6 months, but we'll decide as to how to incorporate it. Number 17.
Was this not also where we added in the labour legislation thing, in this number 3? Because whilst it's up at the top, that refers to 1, and then those that go under there, when it refers to the labour legislation. Now, were we not discussing this number 3 to say the board may suspend the chief ombud or chief financial officer during misconduct fears against him or her, and are we not putting in there according to the labour legislation?
No, this one is suspension with, I think, Honourable Whip, his concern was the issue of suspension without pay.
Yes,
but the laws of this country, you cannot suspend a person without pay. But what is important, you have to ensure that you instill disciplinary measures within a certain period. So I think it is fine, that one. They will rework it around those, and then that one is going to appear again with regulations. Okay. The Mr. Huganin. Listen. Okay. Can you come? From parliamentary
legal. Just something to note is often those cases have been postponed for a long time because people raise issues of due process. So in the regulations, you just have to be aware of that, and sometimes stipulating a time period might create issues in labour law. But so it's an issue that the regulations, of course, will deal with, which Parliament won't deal with. But it's just a comment.
Because we are trying to get away from paying people for an indefinite period. So they have to look at the laws, and then we have to put it here. But we agree that we're not going to put everything here in the legislation. We're going to take it to the regulations. And we are here to represent government. We are here to represent government, therefore, the budget, the government, we oversee it. It's our responsibility, it's our duty. So, in general, I'm not saying that I need to say it's in the trailer.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think that issue, because, it's clear to us. Of course, my colleague, from Parliament Legal Advisor, he might, of course, have raised other issues, but we'll of course have a look at them in terms of the rest. The acting chief ombuds and the chief financial officer. 17(1). The board may in writing appoint any senior employee of the service to act as a chief ombuds or the chief financial officer if the chief ombuds or the chief financial officer A is temporarily unavailable to perform his or her duties in terms of this act, B has vacated or been removed from office, and the new chief executive officer or chief financial officer, as the case may be, has not yet been appointed. Two, the acting chief ombuds or acting chief financial officer may exercise all the powers and must perform all the duties of the chief ombuds or the chief financial officer as the case may be.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we must have a time frame for this acting. We cannot have a person to act forever. A time frame must be stipulated here. Thank you.
That's my exact point. We don't want drama schools.
Chair, it's just a technical matter in clause 17.1b. I think it's 17.1b. It should read, has vacated or been removed from office, and the new chief ombud or chief financial officer, I think it's that being an ear. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Talking about somebody else now. Even myself, I said, here comes the new language now. I'm not commented on it. So let us be consistent.
Thank you, Chairperson. Clause 18, functions of chief ombud. 18, the chief ombud. 18.1, the chief ombud is head of the administration of the service.
The head office, we are only having the chief ombud and the chief financial officer. Are you going to have those people? Only. There won't be any deputy. Except that it's just an appointment of an acting. That's what you are implying. That's okay. Oh. Now I wanted to make sure we didn't say anything.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Functions of Chief Ombud. 18, the Chief Ombud is head of the administration of the service. 2, subject to directives from the board, the functions of the Chief Ombud are 2, A, manage the affairs of the service, B, implement the policies and decisions of the board, C, manage and recruit employees, and D, develop efficient, transparent, and cost-effective administrative systems.
Chair, I'm sorry, on page 8.1, where it says the chief ombud is head, is not the head of.
The recruitment of employees by the ombuds also implies the appointment of those employees. Because I have another point I want to raise later with regards to that function of the ambassador. But I need to understand whether that recruitment also means the ambassador appoints the employees.
It's included under the staff of the service. If you ever look at the staff of the service, it says the chief of bus appoints employees of the service.
Board institution will be the judge of those who are heading the institution to put an individual there according to that main criteria. I think we should really deal with that.
Thank you, Chair. The clause number 19 deals with the functions of the Chief Financial Officer. 19, the functions of the Chief Financial Officer are to A, manage the risk of the service projects, B, assist the board with regards to compliance with its duties in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, C, ensure that the service has adequate income and liquidity to perform its functions, D, ensure that money payable to the services is properly collected, E, ensure that there is adequate control over the assets acquired, managed, or controlled by the service, F, ensure that the liabilities incurred on behalf of the service are properly authorized, G, ensure efficiency and economy of operations and avoidance of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, H, ensure that the financial systems is in line with generally accepted accounting practices and procedures, I, ensure an adequate budgeting and financial system, and J, provide sound financial control systems for the service. Thank you, Chair. Clause number 20, delegation by Chief Umba and Chief Financial Officer. 21, the Chief Umba and the Chief Financial Officer may delegate to an employee of the service any of their powers and assigned any of their duties. 2, any delegation contemplated in subsection 1A may be made subject to such conditions as the board may determine. B, must be communicated to the delegatee in writing. C, may be amended or withdrawn in writing by the chief ombuds or the chief financial officer, as the case may be. D, and does not prohibit the holder of the office that made the delegations from exercising that power or performing that duty. 3.
Madam Chair, I think you have to cater for the situation where the chief ombud might be absent, he might be ill, there might be all the situations. The appointment of employees is always, as Honourable Richard said, going to be in the context of a board-approved plan. So, and there may be situations where the chief ombud is not available for one reason or another. In an organisation such as this, I suggest that you have to have the ability to delegate your responsibilities, I don't think that there's any danger that this person might just go and employ a lot of people. Remember that you have a financial plan, every year you're working to a particular approved plan and under board directives. But it's your job to not mine to see whether there's danger there. I don't see a danger.
Thank you, Chair. No, what we can say here, be clear, delegated function. You cannot delegate unless you do it as per that function that is delegated in writing. So I think Umamu right now the aim is carelessness. But I think we have to see how to put it there. Because we know that the ombud is not appointing each and every worker. That is delegated. But the final approval of those appointments is done by the ombudsperson. So if the ombudsperson is not there, he is sick or whatever, the board appoints somebody on to work with the responsibilities, the ombudsperson. So all right, honorable job. Can you not see?
Just to provide some sort of clarity with regard to that point, it's not going to be like an irresponsible, let me say, you know, delegation of those particular functions, because if we can have a look at clause 22, it says that any delegation contemplated in subsection 1 may be made subject to such conditions as the board may determine. Because it's not going to be, it will provide an opportunity that if that delegation, any delegation contemplated under section 1, may be made subject to the conditions, to such conditions as the board may determine. The board will also have an opportunity, let me say, you know, to not to have a say.
I get this chairperson, but I'm only concerned with one function of the ombud. I'm not concerned with the other. That's fine. I'm concerned with the function of appointing employees and delegating it to any employee. I don't know, because earlier on section 17.1, you speak of a senior employee, but now you are saying any employee. Anybody can just appoint employees. To me, that's how it sounds, unless I'm reading it wrongly.
You know, people take opportunity. People can take chances. So, at least, can you work here, Professor? Or any law, can more money, because there are duties that you may not delegate. But you may not delegate. There are duties that somebody may not delegate those duties. But if the board appoints someone else to work if I'm not there, so that person cannot just delegate to anybody the duties that I'm not doing, but I may not delegate them. So,
Madam Chair, would you be happy if we dealt very specifically with the situation of appointment of employees? And because I think what we might need to do is put in another sub clause here that addresses specifically the problem that you're having.
I think we need to practicalize this and see how it happens. In a normal course of events, the organization will develop a set of delegations. If it's recruitment, it will say an ombuds can appoint up to this level, and the lower level management, I don't think you expect the ombuds to appoint a cleaner. And as such, you know, the delegations are going to be drawn and subjected to scrutiny by the board. And having been approved, then as and when the ombuds deems fit, the ombuds will assign, you know, those delegations in writing to the management. Because the ombuds will not be administering or heading the service alone. He'll be assisted by, you know, other senior managers within the service. So it will be careless of them to over-delegate what is supposed not to be, to have been over-delegated, you know. So I don't think there is any harm in that any.
What I'm saying is, Why can't we delete this? Because this thing is there for subsection 1. Subsection 1 is clear, the chief ombud and the financial officer may delegate to an employee of the service any of his her powers and assign any of his or her duties. Then the delegation contemplated in subsection 1 may be made subject to such conditions as the board may determine. We all agree on that one. Must be communicated to the delegatee in writing. We all agree with that one. May be amended or withdrawn in writing by the chief ombud or chief financial officer, as the case may be. We agree on that one. And does not prohibit the holder of the office that made the delegation from exercising that power or performing that duty. So, law subsection 3, and can you explain to me, why do we need subsection 3?
Notwithstanding a delegation or assignment contemplated in subsection 1, the chief ombud or chief financial officer, as the case may be, is not divested of any powers or duties so delegated or assigned.
Madam Chair, what the 3 means is that even though the chief ombud or the chief financial officer may have delegated a power, they are still able themselves to exercise that power.
But is it there on 2D? 2D. And does not prohibit the holder of the office that made the delegation from exercising that power or performing that duty. That's now, it is there. Now my question is, why do we put 3? Convince me.
I don't think I can convince you, Madam Chair, because I think you're right.
I'm right, yeah. So it's a repetition. Subsection 3. There's no need for subsection 3. Delete it. What are we saying? We are saying we delete 2D. We delete 2D. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Clause number 21, staff of service. 1, a board must determine the staff establishment necessary to enable the service to perform its functions. 2, the chief ombuds appoints employees of the service.
Clause 18 to C
provides that the chief ombuds should manage and recruit employees, while clause 21.2 also stipulates that the chief ombud appoints employees of the service. However, clause 21.3a and b clauses 21.3a and b provides that the board appoints the regional ombud and deputy ombud, as well as full-time and part-time adjudicators. I'm reading the expanded version that I've got in this document. Therefore, would the regional ombud, deputy ombud, and adjudicators not be regarded as employees of the service? Would there, for example, be full-time adjudicators not be subject to the code of conduct as provided for in clause 21b and benefits provided for in clause 21c, subclause 6 and 7?
Thank you, Chair. Three, the board must, for each regional office established, appoint an ombud and a deputy ombuds with suitable qualifications and experience necessary to administer that office under the supervision of the chief ombud. And two, suitable expertise in an understanding of community schemes, governance, and disputes. And B, full-time and part-time adjudicators with unsuitable qualifications and experience necessary to adjudicate disputes under the supervision of an ombuds or a deputy ombud. Three, suitable qualification and experience in community schemes.
Sorry, why full-time adjudicators?
Madam Chair, if you look at the business plan for this particular service, the idea is not to have, is to have some full-time adjudicators and some part-time. It is considered that you need to train and ensure that you have available people who are full-time employees of the service who will adjudicate disputes. But because of the changing demand for disputes, the idea is to make substantial use of part-time adjudicators so as to keep the organization as lean as possible. To do this with absolutely no full-time adjudicators, I suggest might put a very substantial burden on the service in the relationships that it's got to have with the part-timers. The part-timers will have other work. They will probably be in full employment in any event. So to only have part timers, I think is the way in which the business plan looks at this is that for Gauteng, for example, there will be four full time adjudicators. For KwaZulu-Natal, for example, two full-time adjudicators, and then those people would take the bulk of the work whilst they could. So it's almost a load-balancing mechanism, Madam Chair, that there should be some full-time employees doing adjudication and some part.
We are going to look at it. We are not taking it as we are presenting it. We are going to double-check it. Because what we are saying, this service must act work as if or at the local level, and they can have even the evening meetings, schedules, so after work. So I think we are going to look at it. We are not agreeing on this one. We are going to work it. Honorable Labunde, then Honorable Ntagane.
Chairperson, the professor is saying that I use this example, Gauteng will have maybe four full-time adjudicators. I think the number is too big. If there are no disputes to resolve, then it means those full-time adjudicators will have to be paid for nothing. Why can't you reduce the number to one? If there are disputes, then that is when the part-time adjudicators will come in. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, that is why I'm saying we're going to look at it as the committee. Because seemingly we're going to pay people just for sake of paying them. Honorable Richard.
You have made a proposal that maybe but also without castrating the board or even the owners to work and ensure that the service is provided in general to the people, given the fact that we are the one also we are just saying we will need to really do this to be accessible and not be costly to individual members of society. Therefore, it's a given that we must have more people if you want to move on that. But how do we do that in terms of demand and supply? I guess we should really discuss it among ourselves. I appreciate.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. For the employees contemplated in subsection 2 are appointed subject to the terms and conditions determined by the Chief Ombud within the financial limits determined in accordance with the human resource policy approved by the Minister, which policy may make provisions for non-pensionable allowances for employees. The chief ombud must determine and supply each employee with a copy of the code of conduct applicable to all members of staff of the service and justiciable for purposes of disciplinary proceedings to ensure A, compliance with any applicable law, B, the effective, efficient and economical use of the resources of the service, and C, the promotion and maintenance of a high standard of professional ethics. 6. A person in the employ of the service becomes a member of the Government Employee Pension Fund, contemplated in Section 2 of the Government Employees Pension Law, 1996, Proclamation Number 21 of 1996. And is entitled to pensions and retirement benefits as if that person were in service in a post classified in a division of the public service. Staff from public entities reporting to the minister may be employed by the service subject to the provisions of the Labour Relations Act, 1995, Act Number 66 of 1995, and the Human Resource Policy referred to in subsection 2. 8. Staff may also be transferred or seconded to the service from the public service subject to the provisions of the Public Service Act, 1994, Proclamation Number 103 of 1994, and the Human Resource Policy referred to in subsection 3. Funds of Service. 22.1, Honorable Chair, the funds of the service consist of A, money appropriated by Parliament. B, levies collected from community schemes with the approval of the Minister. C, fees for services rendered based on cost recovery. D, interest derived from investments of the service. E, loans raised by the service subject to Section 23. F, donations or contributions received by the service with approval of the minister. G, subsidies and grants from organs of state.
Just, I think in total about 4 issues. The first one, that an explanation was required as to how the bill will be self-funding if Parliament has to contribute. The second issue was around the levies collected from community schemes. The submission argued that another expense which will be levied, it's another expense that will be levied on properties with the result that either the purchase price of properties will have to be raised to meet such obligation. And if the developer will have to fit the bill, or if in the event of payment to be made to the body corporate, by the body corporate, the levies will have to be increased accordingly. In such cases, the owners may not use the service provided, but will still end up paying for the service. It will also have an effect on the already challenging property market, whereby owners are expected to lower their selling price to accommodate limited funds provided by the banking institutions. There was also a comment related to clause 22F. Suggesting that there be proper checks and balances in place in order to ensure transparency and avoid undue influence and possible corruption when it comes to donations and contributions received by the service.
I think also, with the levies paid, although we're now querying the levies, whether it's the occupier or the owner who pays those levies. And then what happens where a property has been repossessed? Who pays those levies?
Banking institutions. In our view, the bill is unclear as to whether the owner or the occupier is liable for the payment of this levy. Where a mortgage has been repossessed, the property has properties in their possession due to customers having defaulted on their home loan agreements. Are mortgages in these instances also required to pay this levy? They raised the issue around whether the service will hold a preferment right over mortgages, or whether the rights of a body corporate to collect levies and or the rights of a municipality to collect rates and taxes or utility charges. Linked to the above question in respect to the preferential right of the ombuds, if this is to be the case and or whether arrears in respect of such levies could negatively impact on the transferability of such properties, it follows that mortgagees holding any interest in the scheme must be advised of any action that is to be taken by the service, and that the service must request the consent of all such mortgagees holding any interest in the scheme prior to any action being taken by them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try and go through those things as they came up. Firstly, why would money have to be appropriated by Parliament? I think that the honourable members have looked at the business plan. Is that right, Madam Chair? Okay. The business plan, I think, sets out fairly clearly what the position is relative to initial funding from Parliament, and then perhaps depending on how the service manages to recover costs and sell services, the question of top up funding. In fact. So the idea is that there's a multifaceted funding model which would include payment of monies by Parliament initially, hopefully would, and really it comes, the projections issue suggests that it's a toss-up. You're either going to top up from the department's budget, or you're going to reduce the services that you give, or you're going to levy community schemes. The Act is very clear that it is not owners or occupiers who would have to pay, the bill. The provision in the bill thus far has got nothing to do with levying levies from owners or occupiers. It would be from community schemes. There is no, if you have a look at, you're looking at me, through you, Chair, the provision in the bill, it's right towards the end, but it deals quite specifically, it's clause 59 that deals with that, and it would be the community scheme. There is not any provision in this to answer the mortgagee's question. There's not any suggestion that there should be a preferent claim. This would simply be a mouse that the service would, in the event of it having to raise levies from schemes, this would it would have a claim against them. There is nothing in here, as there is in the Sectional Titles Act, which would make it a preferent claim or a claim in liquidation, which is the official status of the levy claim.
Things do happen, so we'll see how to close that gap. All the things must not happen in the manner that they are not supposed to happen, then I say that.
Thank you, Chair. The service must, subject to Section 23, utilize the funds to defray expenses incurred by it in the performance of its functions. Application of Public Finance Management Act. 23, the service subject to the Public Finance Management Act and its financial management preparations and submission of budgets, preparation of financial statements, audits, annual reports, and reporting must be done in accordance with the Public Finance Management Act. Number 24 deals with the tabling in Parliament. The Minister must table in Parliament the annual report of the service, A, within 14 days after receiving the report, if Parliament is in session, or if Parliament is not in session, within 40 days after the commencement of the next parliamentary session. Thank you, Chair. Delegation by Minister.
I'm just not so sure about this 14-day thing, because I don't know how that sort of ties us down. And you know, do we not need to submit a specific time frame? Not just the 14 days. You know, there seems to be a bit of a lack of accountability here.
No, this is a normal practice. It's a normal practice. In all legislation, yes, all the reports are supposed to be brought within, but we know that there are sessions. Yeah. So let's agree. Can we agree that we leave this one? Because it was even a comment from the public. So I think, you know, we can leave this as it is.
Thank you, Chair. Delegation by Minister. 25.1, the Minister may delegate to the Director General any of his or her powers, or assign any of his or her functions conferred or imposed on him or her by this Act. 2, any delegation contemplated in Subsection 1, A, may be made subject to such condition as the Minister may determine, B, must be in writing, C, may be amended or withdrawn by the Minister in writing, and D, does not prohibit the Minister from exercising their power or performing their duty. 3, the Minister may not delegate the power to make regulations or appoint a member of the board. Additional function. 27, provisions for information of information. That's page 12, yes, Chair. Okay. A, the minister may direct the board to submit to him or her specific information. B, the board must comply with any directive contemplated in paragraph A. 2.
It is just a question of legislative drafting. Well, you notice that 27.1 is that sub 1 is one sub section, right? So that paragraph A, it is the correct way of drafting it, Chair, that when you are within the same sub section, you don't have to repeat and say subsection A, you just refer to a paragraph. It's a question of legislative drafting, the correct legislative drafting style that is accepted. No, it's not. It's not. It's not a question. The board must comply with any directive contemplated in paragraph A. 2. The service must provide the minister or a person authorized by the minister with access to such books, accounts, documents, and assets of the service as the minister may require. 3. The minister may appoint a person to investigate the affairs or financial positions of the service and compliance by the service with this act, and may recover from the service the fees and disbursement incurred by that person during the investigation. 4. An individual member of the board and an employee of the service, if requested by the minister, must comply with subsections 1 and 2 to the extent that they are able to do so.
On a directive by the minister. And 4, an individual member of the board and an employee of the service on a directive by the minister must comply.
Intervention by Minister. 28. The Minister may direct the service to take any action specified by the Minister if the service A is in financial difficulty or is otherwise being mismanaged. B is unable to perform its functions effectively due to dissensions among board members. C has acted unfairly or in a discriminatory or in an inequitable manner. D has failed to comply with any law. E has failed to comply with any directive issued by the minister under this act. Or has obstructed the minister or a person authorized by the minister in performing a function in terms of this act. Clause 2, a directive contemplated in subsection 1 must state the nature of the deficiency, B, the steps which must be taken to remedy the situation, and C, a reasonable period within which the steps contemplated in paragraph B must be taken.
Got the same thing as we had up there in 27.1b, that it's subsection, the reference here should be to subsection 2 brackets, b brackets, instead of paragraph, but we've now been advised that it's the way they write it. They don't. But that to replace paragraph B with the wording subsection 2 brackets B brackets.
No, I'm not quite sure what we are talking about yet. So, yeah, because subsection and paragraph cannot. I think one needs to study the general.
That is why I'm saying, Mama, let's leave it.
Yeah.
We are still going to run through this process as the portfolio committee with our parliamentary legal unit and the state law advisor. So let's leave it for now. But siyaiva njengoba beyitsho, siyaiva, siyimamele, we are listening. Parliamentary unit.
Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to 28.2c, the period reasonable period seems vague, and we suggest that you could insert the words a reasonable period not exceeding 6 months.
Thank you, Chair. Three, if the service fails to remedy the situation within the stated period, the minister may, after having A, given the service a reasonable opportunity to be heard, and B, afforded the service a hearing on any submission received, replace one or more members of the board, and where circumstances so require, appoints an administrator to take over the relevant functions of the service until the member or members of the board has or have been replaced. Four, if the minister appoints an administrator to take over a function of the service in terms of subsection 3, A, the administrator may do anything which the service might otherwise be empowered or required to do in terms of this act. B, the board may not, while the administrator is responsible for that function, exercise any of his powers or perform perform any of its duties relating to that function. C, and an employee or contractor of the service must comply with any lawful directives issued by administrator in terms of this act. Five.
I just want to know if the administrator have a time frame. Because you wanna experience is the best teacher. I found a teacher in the bottom. You wanna a language as it in the bottom is different on the ground. And as the dollar the corner. Can you look at this, please?
I think let's deal with five and see if that maybe does not address the concern of the honorable member.
Okay.
Five, once the minister is satisfied that the service is once more able to perform its functions, effectively the minister must terminate the appointment of the administrator. The cost associated with the appointment of the administrator must be borne by the service.
No, the problem, when is the minister going to review? I'm sure that is the problem. It must be reviewed at a certain period. Minister, ukhalele madoda, niyay understand nani? Uba ngabe minister komuntu owamdonsa indlebe. If no one pulls the minister, ngendlebe, akazuyazi le nto le, uzawuba njengathi nje sesimdonora. At least must be reviewed at a certain period. There must be a review one period. Work on that.
Yes, Chair. 29 regulations. The minister must, after consultation with the service, make regulations regarding A, meetings to be held by the board, regularity of meetings.
Why can't you say after consultation?
The minister must, after consultation with the board or the service, make regulations regarding.
What we're requesting here is to change the service after consultation with the board, because it's the board that is responsible. I mean, that is a delegated function to the board to make regulations, because those regulations are made by the board, but they are approved by the minister. So that consultation is between the minister and the board. Yes. So we are saying, instead of saying the service, let's say the board.
Just to clarify my mind, I think the legal team will assist me also. Because I can see in some of the sentences they use the board, in some sentences they use service. Whether there's no material difference between the two or not. Because in many other areas, we are putting the board. In some areas, we put the service, simply mean interchangeably, using the board and the service. If there's no material difference between the two, wouldn't be, I think we wouldn't cause any problem. But if there are material differences, then we must assist us to understand what is the difference. When you call it the board now, and another sentence is the service, another sentence is the board. I think there must be material differences somewhere in terms of your legal way of phrasing things. That can assist me also to understand exactly why you're using them interchangeably.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, the honorable member is raising a valid point. But, Chair, I agree with him, Chair. There are material differences. It is the word service and the word board is used interchangeably, and it is relevant. For instance, here you note that in 29.1a Roman letter 1, it's talking about meetings to be held by the board. It is a meeting which holds, it is the board which holds meetings. And also, in even in 29.1a Roman letter 11, it states about resolutions signed by members of the board. So it is members which sign resolutions and also proceedings of the board. Therefore, Chair, in my view, it is correctly used interchangeably, Chair, where it is relevant, it is the service, where it is relevant to the board. And also, Chair, in 29.1, well, the service, Chair, is a legal entity, and it acts through its board, as stated in the previous clause. Therefore, Chair, if the minister will consult the service when he or she wants to make regulations, but by consulting the service, Chair, the service is a legal entity, Chair. So, in the other words, the minister will consult the individual, the board, in effect. Chair. So, in my view, Chair, I don't see any difference to having service remain as it is in this particular clause. No, honorable member, what big, there is any legal issue or constitutional issue. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, maybe we need to go back to the definitions and understand what it is that we are talking about, because the definitions here put it as they do. And Section 3 establishes this juristic person, the community service scheme on that service. And Section 6 establishes a board to be known as the board of the service. We need to probably understand the definition, what it really means. The board is responsible for the management and control of the service. It is in control and management of this juristic person. This is how we should understand it.
Madam Chair, that's exactly right. You have an executive committee. That board is the executive of the service.
That the team that is drafting must assist us from time to time. If there are no major issues, therefore it's fine. If there are real major issues, you should just change service to a board when the meaning of the entire clause anyway got lost. Otherwise, interpretation of the act will give you a real problem in terms of those interpretations. My view is that we'll look at it anyway once we have come up as a member of the parliament.
Well, thank you, Chair. 29. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Repeat. The minister must, after consultation with the Board of Service, make regulations regarding meetings to be held by the board, regularity of meetings, special meetings, the taking of decisions at meetings, convening of meetings and notices of meetings, meetings by telephone or video conference or other means of communication, quorum at meetings, assignment of meetings, person presiding at meetings, minutes, resolution signed by members of the board, execution of documents, and the proceedings of the board. B. Levies payable by schemes to the service and at what intervals such levies are payable. C. Schemes which may be entitled to discounts or waivers of fees. D. Applications, application, adjudication, and fees payable by persons who make use of the service. E.
Thank you, Jay. I think the issue is around clarity on who qualifies for waivers or discounts. That there should be guidelines, just prescribed guidelines drafted in advance so that there's clarity in the interest of fairness and transparency. I think that's also a comment that came from the financial and banking service in it as well.
Say the minister must, after consultation with the Board of Service, make regulations regarding A, regarding B, redact all this CEH, so it's covered. Let's agree on it, that it is covered.
Rate and interest payable on overdue levies and fees. Any matter that this Act requires or permits to be prescribed, and generally any ancillary or incidental administrative or procedural matters that it is necessary to prescribe for the proper implementation or administration of this Act.
I'm going to just go back a little bit. Under 29... 1AX. Yeah, where it says minutes. Is that minutes of meetings? I also want to just, when we're referring to meetings, is this general meetings or is this board meetings or is it any meetings that might take place? I just want to be clear about that. It just seems to be a bit vague. Minutes of board meetings? Any minutes?
The intention, these are meetings to be held by the board, and then everything else that follows that is relative to the board meetings. This couldn't conceptually apply to any other meetings. This is not an act that deals this doesn't deal with any other meetings.
meeting in effect, not necessarily the board members. So, you are right for that. So, let's put it. Meeting of the board meeting.
Sure, the AI will not set that term.
AI?
Maybe.
Oh.
Because you can't say board in all.
Meeting to be held by board.
Yeah.
Thirty, Chair, judicial management and liquidation. Clause 30, the service may not be placed under. Oh.
It's just issues of clarity raised by the banking and financial services in around subclause F, rates of interest payable on overdue levies and fees. Questions were just raised, requests for clarity on what are the effects of such where the owner has a mortgage, what is the collection process that will be adopted, and just the thinking around that, and where legal action is taken by the service to recover all outstanding monies, will they sue on movable or immovable property?
Madam Chair, let me say this again. The levies are not payable by owners or occupiers. This contemplates levies that are payable by schemes. So none of the questions asked by the Banking Council apply. They would apply if the levies were payable by owners. But in situations where they are payable by schemes, they don't apply at all.
It's not clear here. Your explanation is not clear. This item is just standing on its own. The schemes are there in C, but this one is F, and it's coming from the minister. Must do this, and then under A, meetings to be held by the board, and then we do have all those to. We are saying all those issues that are from A, those issues that are from B, those issues are from C, those issues are from D, E, and then F as well. So there would be regulation. So what is the question? Let's answer this question. Those regulations, about the regulations we are referring to. So can we repeat, get the question, what is all about?
I think what the banking institution, what they were asking was, what are the effects of such levies where the owner has a mortgage bond? What is the collection process that will be adopted? Where legal action is taken by the service to recover all outstanding monies, will they sue on movable or immovable property?
And Chair, they won't sue the owners at all, because the levies are not payable by owners. The levies in terms of clause 59 are payable by community schemes. So the fear that a bank with its mortgage may have doesn't apply.
Can we clarify this? Because it's not clarified here. That is why these people, they are asking this question, because they want to understand, because they are raising the issue of mortgage bonds. So if it's not going to affect them, it's going to affect the people with schemes. It has to be clarified. I don't know.
I think the issue that relates to that is, with regard to this provision specifically, it deals with matters that the minister may regulate upon. So the minister may make regulations regarding the rates of interest payable on overdue levies and fees. So those matters and those clarities should be provided for the regulations that the minister will have to, you know, to develop.
I'm getting a bit confused. It must be that we're at the end of the day. But now I want to actually stop and just understand this thing properly, so that I don't move on not knowing what I'm talking about. firms charge levies. In my understanding, your owners are paying levies in order to keep the schemes thing. So I mean, ultimately, it might come out of the scheme's money, but it's coming out of the owner's pocket, I would imagine, the levies. So I'm not too sure that I understand when we keep on saying that it's not the owner or the occupier. I don't understand that, because you're just saying here, you know, my glasses on again, sorry. Rates of interest payable on overdue levies and fees. Yes. I'm not understanding this distinction, because individual people will have to pay into the scheme. So I don't see the distinction between the two that you keep making.
Yeah, I'm not convinced, because yeah, you have put the schemes on fee already. But now, yeah, for a person, this is going to think of general, as the banking sector has raised a concern. They want to be sure that there won't be any disputes that are arising from these clauses. So, Honorable Dara, at the end of the day, there will be disputes. So, we have to be clear on what we are saying, we are putting in here.
No, I'm in almost a similar situation, Chair. I think my earlier understanding was that the individual occupants or owners, they will pay levies and whatever to the scheme. And if the scheme, then that would pay the third person. And then if the member of a community scheme doesn't pay, it will be a responsibility between a member and the scheme for that person to pay. But if the scheme as a whole doesn't pay, because the scheme is a juristic person, then that person then will charge whatever, take to court, will take not individual occupier, but will take the member of the scheme, because the scheme is the person, is a service, in fact. I can be sued as a plaintiff and sued. As a result of that, I think is a clarity really that maybe we should try to expand on it ourselves. Because I think the banking council, surely they will know, they've got consultants, they've got a lot of people. If it's not clear to them, I guess that in the majority of people then also will be clear so much. Because I do think that they do have resources anyway to hire very competent people to advise them even before them making this proposal. Surely there must be something that is not clear somewhere. But I think in the layman's language, that's how I understood what you are trying to do. And then, of course, if you told it doesn't pay, is occupying a scheme. The scheme will simply evict to stall. Whatever thing, of course, the regulations and rules and everything within the law, they will evict stall. But the third person can't come and evict stall. Because the agreement or contractual arrangement is between the scheme and the outside person, not stall. Therefore, I think it's something that is, my understanding is that what we are trying to make in terms of the service, the person, and also their board, also the person that is managing the affairs of the scheme. But I guess that if you can also try to simplify it in order for us just to understand it.
Well, I know we can do it.
Madam Chair, we will do whatever you want. The issue raised by the Banking Council is the question they're asking is, how does it affect their security? Will the service attach the units owned by the owners? And of course they won't, because as Honourable Richard said, it's not a claim against the owners, it's a claim against the schemes. And of course, as Honourable Bowman said, ultimately any cost will filter through to the owners. Yes, but the Banking Council's concern about attachment of security, if they just read that last clause, they wouldn't ask the question anymore. They wouldn't need to ask the question. But I completely agree. If you need it to be made more simple, we'll do it.
placed under judicial management or liquidation except on the authority of an act of parliament. Security of information, clause number 31. A person may not disclose any information kept by the service unless A, it is done in terms of and subject to any applicable law that compels or authorizes the disclosure. B, it is necessary for the proper functioning of the service. C, it is legally required for the purpose of monitoring, evaluating, investigating, or considering any activity relating to the service. 32, documents relating to litigation. 32, the service must provide the minister with copies of all pleadings, affidavits, and other documents in his possession relating to any legal proceedings brought by or against the service. Limitation on liability.
About this perhaps being too onerous, and that attorneys or whoever, they actually do keep documents, and if the minister requires that, he or she can call for them. The service must provide the minister with copies of all pleadings, affidavits, and other documents. Where do we keep all this? Where does the minister keep all this stuff?
This could be cured, as suggested, with a simple insertion: the service must on request, so that it's then limited to what the minister asks for.
Just for clarity's sake and for the chair, clause 8, that is a judicial management and liquidation. And I guess that every existing service of the board and any organization within the borders of the Republic are not above the law. Because otherwise, if you are setting up a service, in fact, this one is going to be very powerful, but also you need parliament to enact for it anyway to be under liquidation or judicial. Because there may be clashes between the members, individual members, and the scheme, who may take the scheme as a whole, was represented by the board, to court. The board in many other areas, courts in many other areas, they do appoint administrators. They do appoint administrators if there's dysfunctionality, there's problem management, there's this and that. But it seems here we are saying the court really generally can't take a decision to manage or to liquidate the service, unless, of course, it's an act of parliament. It seems you have given them real exception. I'm not sure if it's correct to do that or not. Maybe there'd be a very strong reason why you should do that, because I think all organs like that should be subjected to the court rulings. I don't think they should be protected from the court. Of course, the court is, with due reasonableness, they wouldn't really take any decision that is contrary to the interests of the members of the speech. I'm not sure, but I'm not married to this, what I'm saying, but just to clarify myself, why are we saying this anyway? That we need an act of parliament for them to be managed by judiciary or to also to for deputation.
I'm not sure why.
You're
doing that.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that this is a fairly normal sort of clause for this type of entity. Remember, Madam Chair, that anyone, if you owe somebody 500 rand and you've got a fight with them, you can apply for their liquidation. This is an entity that's been set up in order to perform a public function, and the idea that it shouldn't be subject to disruption by somebody who owes it 500 rand to me makes perfect sense.
No, I think it's a normal practice, well, that's this one, in all legislations of this type that are established through, I mean, these entities that are established through Parliament. So I don't think it has got, it's going to have an impact on the judicial issues per se that are necessary. I don't think so. So let's agree on that one.
but tell something. I think earlier on, I think I would have liked to have had some explanation of what exactly it means in practice.
What does this mean in practice?
That it may not be placed under judicial management or liquidation.
Madam Chair, through you, we have already been through the provision, which is clause 28, that deals with intervention by the minister. So if there's problems, if the thing isn't working properly, the minister is the person responsible to make it work properly, and he's been given a number of tools in order to do that. Now, what we're doing is taking this particular entity out of the normal judicial management orders. It will be business rescue context. We're saying the minister is the person who must fix this thing if it gets into administrative dysfunction. And he's got tools to do that. We are basically stopping a man in the street trying to do the same thing.
At the end of the day, the minister is going. The minister is going to come before Parliament, and recommend that this must be liquidated. At the end of the day, finally, I'm sure it not represents that.
Mr. Chair, we deal with clause number 33, limitation on liability. Neither the service nor any employee of the service is liable for any damage or loss caused by A, the exercise of a power or the performance of a duty under this Act, or B, the failure to exercise a power or perform a duty under this Act, unless the exercise of or failure to exercise the power or performance or failure to perform the duty was unlawful, grossly negligent, or in bad faith.
We have the view that it should also make reference to conduct in contravention of the PFMA.
Where we are saying the failure to exercise a power or perform a duty under this Act, unless the exercise of or failure to exercise the power of performance or failure to perform the duty was unlawful, grossly negligent, or in bad faith and in contravention of the PMC.
I don't think so.
I'm having a problem of singling out only the PFMA because here it relates to any law which might, any conduct which might be lawful. So it will be a bit dangerous for us to single out one particular legislation because there is a host of legislation that can be, that a person can act in contravention of.
Stated that neither the service nor any employee of the service is liable for any damage or loss caused by the exercise of a power or the performance of a duty under this Act, or the failure to exercise a power or perform a duty under this Act, unless exercise of or failure to exercise the power or performance or failure to perform the duty was unlawful, grossly negligent, or in bad faith. So I'm saying, why can't it be including contravention of PMFA?
Well, I think in this case, I think advocate that is correct. Because once you made mention of one, surely then simply means that the only one that will apply would be PFMA. But there are many laws and regulations that cover the overall service. And I guess that we should be as open as we can on this one, but not specific. If you cite one, let us cite some of them. Because by citing one, simply means that others are not applied in terms of this Act. it can cause unnecessary problem for us. There's no harm really, the way it is drafted, to capture every law of the country that shouldn't be contravened. Because I think about 12 of them that are existing in terms of the overall administration and the, of the affairs, of the administrative issues in South Africa. If we cite one, I think we can be, I think that all relevant applicable laws will be far better, because therefore we are securing ourselves that all of them really apply, yeah, rather than one, because I think, I know that we are always, because administratively PFMA has been much more, but there are 12 of them that are existing anyway that we should respect all of them. Therefore, I think if we can try, I think the leadership, they can try to get some phrase that will assist us to get out of that.
I think what Adhikari was meaning, that there was more, the PFA has things in addition to being unlawful, grossly negligent or in bad faith, they have other criteria which they're not necessarily captured in unlawful, grossly negligent or in bad faith. Yes. Yeah, which are lesser qualifications than that too.
So we are now at page 14. Offences and penalties. Clause 34. 1. Any person who A. fails to provide access to any books, accounts, documents or assets when required to do so under this Act. B. fails to comply with a directive issued under this Act. C. fails or refuses to give data or information or give false or misleading data or information when required to give information under this Act. D. intentionally refuses to perform a duty or obstruct any person in the exercise of a power or performance of a duty in terms of this Act. E. accepts any unauthorized fees or reward, either direct or indirect, as a result of a person's position with the service. F. uses the name, logo or design of the service without authorization, without authority. Or G. contravenes or fails to comply with Section 31, is guilty of an offence, is liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment. 2. Where a person is convicted for a second or a subsequent conviction for an offence contemplated in subsection 1, he or she is liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment. 35, independence of service. All service employees must act independently and impartially in making decisions with regards to the resolution of disputes. 2, once an application is referred to an adjudicator, an ombuds plays no role in relation to the substance of the dispute or the outcome sought by the applicant. Practice directives. 36. The chief ombuds must issue practice directives with regards to any matter pertaining to the operations of the service. 2. Practice directive must, subject to this act and the regulations, direct the performance of any act in the operation of the service. 37. Privileges, immunities, and non-waiver. 37.1. In performing their functions in terms of this act, the chief ombuds, an ombuds, a deputy ombuds, and adjudicator have the same privileges and immunities from liabilities as a judge of the high court. 2. The privilege in respect of defamation that the privilege in respect of defamation that applies to any proceedings before the High Court and to the documents and statements in such proceedings must apply to the adjudication in terms of this act. A person may not waive or limit the exercise of rights in terms of this act or act contrary to any provisions of this act. Chapter 3, Honourable Members, deals with applications. Application Act, clause number 38. 1. Any person may make an application if such person is a party to or affected materially by a dispute. 2. An application must be A. made in a prescribed manner and as may be required by practice directives. B. lodged with an ombud. And C. accompanied by the prescribed application fee. 3. The application must include statements setting out A. the relief sought by the applicant, which relief must be within the scope of one or more of the prayers for the relief contemplated in section 39. B. the name and address of each person the applicant considers to be affected materially by the application, and C. the ground on which the relief is sought. 4. The applicant considers that the application qualifies for a discount or waiver of adjudication fee. The application must include a request for such discount or waiver. Prayers for relief. This one is important, all of them. Yes, within the legal sector, we understand what this means. An application made in terms of Section 38 must include one or more of the following orders. In respect of financial issues, A. an order requiring the association to take out insurance or to increase the amount of insurance. B. an order requesting the association to take action under an insurance policy to recover an amount. C. an order declaring that a contribution levied on owners or occupiers or the way it is to be paid is incorrectly determined or unreasonable, and an order for the adjustment of the contribution to a correct or reasonable amount, or an order for its payment in a different way.
said repeatedly, ukuthi lento ayizoaffecta i-occupiers is going to affect the members, the owners. So can we be clarified here? Where does the occupier come in here?
Madam Chair, in a situation such as a shared block company, that person is not going to be an owner, that person is going to be an occupier. So the owner and occupiers, there is always this, just because of the way people hold rights in various types of community schemes, there are going to be people who are occupiers and people who are owners. And both of those people will have the right to come if they have the liability to pay a contribution. They will be able to come to the service and say it's not fair. It hasn't been calculated correctly, or it's wrong. So you need to cover both of those of those situations.
An order.
Thinking around what you say there.
Yeah.
In a scheme, whether you own a unit or shares or what, you own something, and that share would translate into a concrete something. So I think we're back again to the same query that we seem to be having about, I think you perhaps and me, we understand differently in, you know, the share concept, because even if it's shares, it's still a share in something, concrete, bricks and mortar.
I'm sure we do see it the same way. I'm sorry, but through you, Madam Chair. The short answer is that it is possible for community schemes, in a community scheme, for people who are occupiers or owners, whether they are occupiers of common areas or private areas, to be liable for particular financial obligations, for contributions of some sort. And what this I do believe one needs to cover both situations, and I'm not sure what the difficulty is. In essence, if you have a secured right to something and you've been asked to pay an amount in respect of that area, this gives you the right to come and say that that's not fair.
D, an order requiring the association to have its accounts or accounts for a specified period audited by an auditor specified in the order. Two, in respect of behavioral issues, A, an order that a particular behavior or default constitutes a nuisance and requiring the relevant person to act or refrain from acting in a specified way. B, if certified that an animal kept in a private area or on common areas is causing a nuisance or hazard or is unduly interfering with someone else's peaceful or use and enjoyment of his or her private area or common area, an order requiring the owner or occupier in charge of the animal. One, to take specified actions to remedy the nuisance, hazard or interference, or to remove the animal. animal is being kept in a community scheme contrary to the scheme governance documentation and requiring the owner or occupier in charge of the animal to remove it. Or D, an order for the removal of all articles placed on or attached illegally to parts of a common area or a private area. 3. In respect of scheme governance issues, A, an order requiring the association to record a new scheme's governance provisions, you know, consistent with a provision approved by the association. B, an order requiring the association to approve and record a new scheme governance provision. C, an order declaring that the scheme governance provision is invalid and requiring the association to approve and record a new scheme governance provisions to remove the invalid provision. Or D, an order declaring that the scheme governance provision, having regard to the interests of all owners and occupiers in the community scheme, is unreasonable and requiring the association to approve and record a new scheme governance provision. A, to remove the provision. 2, if appropriate, to restore an earlier provision, to amend the provision, or to substitute a new provision.
I'm sorry to do this, but I was looking for something that was going to follow on the animal nuisance and the noise. When it's human beings and party, and I don't see that. I thought there was going to be, but I think it should also come under in respect of behavioural issues, and I don't see it there.
Chair, but it's intended to be in 2A. A particular behaviour that constitutes a nuisance would, for example, cover the situation of loud parties, such as Honourable Bowman describes.
Yes, under A.
Actually creates huge problems in community living if people don't adhere to, you know, respect for peace and quiet at times.
Madam Chair, the basis of this whole thing is that people living close to each other must respect one another and they must not create a nuisance. I think perhaps Honourable Bowman is struggling with the concept of nuisance, because a nuisance is any action or a failure to act which causes unreasonable disturbance of another person's peaceful occupation. So the word nuisance covers everything that you've spoken of. Nuisance doesn't need to be defined, because that is a common law term. It's not possible to define nuisance. Perhaps you could.
I mean, people can say described in the common law. Mm-hmm. How can they define it?
Then it would no longer be common law if you describe anything. If I shine a light into my neighbor's property, into the bedroom, if I create a disturbance of sound, light, anything. It even includes growing of trees and all kinds of things. So it is best left as nuisance, Chair. It is quite well understood. And once you define it, you're going to alter the common law. And that would create problems, because the common law has been developed with nuisance law for quite a long period of time. And it includes a very wide category of and they have specific tests on what is a nuisance. And if you, for example, if the nuisance existed before and new neighbors moved in, it's all very well defined. So that would create quite potential conflict.
All right, I will go with that because I'm hearing from the legal side that I'm just concerned that when this does sort of end up in courts or something, and then, because I know these legal beavers, they come in with different interpretations, you know, on something, but if that's generally accepted in legal terms, that it can't be interpreted in any other way, then I'm fine with that.
I agree with my colleague Afghan Fakir Mukesh Chair. It is established in some case jurisprudence what nuisance is. For instance, there are several cases. For instance, there are two adjacent lands, farms, and then the one farm spills certain toxic waste on another farm. That is a nuisance. There are several examples in our legal system that is covered in nuisance. So there will be any danger of misunderstanding when it comes to adjudications in a court of law what a nuisance is. Thank you, Chair.
In respect of meetings, an order requiring the association to call a general meeting of its members to deal with specified business. B, an order declaring that a purported meeting of the executive committee or a purported general meeting of the association was not validly convened. C, an order declaring that a resolution purportedly passed at a meeting of the executive committee or at a general meeting of the association and was void or is invalid. D, an order declaring that a motion for resolution considered by a general meeting of the association was not passed because the opposition to the motion was unreasonable under the circumstances and giving effect to motion as was originally proposed, or a variation of the motion proposed. C, an order declaring that a particular resolution passed at a meeting is void on the ground that it unreasonably interferes with the rights of an individual owner or occupier, or the rights of a group of owners or occupiers. 5, in respect of management services, an order requiring a managing agent to comply with the terms of a person's contract of appointment and any applicable code of conduct or authorization. B, an order declaring that the association that does or does not have the right to terminate the appointment of a managing agent and that the appointment is or is not terminated. 6, in respect of works pertaining to private areas and common areas, an order requiring the association to have repairs and maintenance carried out.
B, an order requiring the relevant person, one, to carry out specified repairs or have specified repairs made, or two, to pay the applicant an amount fixed by the adjudicator, or reimbursement of repairs carried out or to be carried out in respect of the property by the applicant. C, an order requiring the association, one, to carry out within a specified time, specified work to or on the common areas for the use or convenience or safety of owners or occupiers, or two, not to carry out specified works. D, an order declaring that the association's decisions to reject a proposal to make improvements on or alterations to common areas is unreasonable, and requiring the association A, to agree to the proposal, or two, to ratify the proposal on specified terms. E, an order requiring the association one, to acquire within a specified time specified property for the use, convenience or safety of owners or occupiers, two, not to acquire specified property, or three, to dispose of specified property within a specified time. F, an order declaring that an owner or occupier reasonably requires exclusive use rights over a certain part of a common area that the association has unreasonably refused to grant such rights, and requiring the association to give exclusive use rights to the owner or occupier on terms that may require a payment or periodic payments to the association over a specified part of a common area. G, an order obliging an owner or occupier to accept obligations in respect of a defined part of a common area. 7, in respect of a general or other issues, an order declaring that the applicant has been wrongfully denied access to information or documents, and requiring the association to make such information or documents available within a specified time. Or B, any other order proposed by the chief ombud. 40, further information or material for applications.
Madam Chairperson, may I just draw to the committee's attention that when working through the sectional title schemes management bill, one of the changes that you made to that bill was where for the collection of levies, you might recall that you said it wasn't only going to be a court, but it was also could be collected via the ombud service. So perhaps if we could just make a note that in our first in 39.1, we need to add another prayer to cater for that particular thing, because that wasn't as originally contemplated.
Thank you very much.
Guaranteed.
members can finalize